This is a production of Netcast Studio, online media for today's society. The new media broadcasting network dedicated to providing you content as it relates to your life. Whether it's technology, sports, educational, cultural, hobbies, or history, Netcast Studio has it all at netcaststudio.com.
Tech of Sports, episode 32 for October 31st, 2012. Broadcaster Steve Craig. This week on the Tech of Sports, Steve Craig. Netcast Studio mobile apps are a great way to receive our content for your smart devices. There's an app for both iOS and Android. And don't forget Stitcher Radio, the Stitcher Radio app for all iOS devices. Stitcher, it's an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone and tablet. Stitcher, it's smart radio for your smartphone. And the Tech of Sports is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network at techpodcast.com. If it's tech, it's here. Tech of Sports is also a production of Netcast Studio at netcaststudio.com. You can join us every week on Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific at netcaststudio.com/live. You can join the chat room and listen to the show live. I'd like to welcome everyone tonight. We're recording early because we have a couple logistical issues this week, and I got a great guest, and we're going to have a lot of fun here tonight, and we're going to talk about technology and radio and broadcasting and a few other things with Steve Craig. He's a veteran broadcaster, and for more than two decades, he's been playing music and entertaining the masses on the radio, mainly in Atlanta and New York, but a lot of some other places along the way. He's won numerous awards for best DJ and radio show in Atlanta, New York, and I think he's one of the best musical minds in the country. He also loves technology and sports, and believe it or not, there's a sensitive side to him. And Steve, it's great to have you on tonight. Good talking to you again.
Good to talk to you too, Rick. A sensitive side? What do you mean?
Yes. Yeah. Well, we'll find out. We'll find out a little later. We'll make you sweat that out a little bit.
Uh-huh. I know you were talking about the different available ways that you could listen. What about Prodigy? Genie? Anybody?
Wow. That's going back. Did you ever participate in a BBS back in the day?
Yes, I did. My first BBS was for the band Ween, of all bands. There was it was pretty much a forum discussion, billboard type of, or bulletin board kind of thing. But that was when I was first diving into Prodigy, at the beginning of what would become the World Wide Web. And then I converted to America Online because they had easy access at the time and through dial-up. And things sure have changed. And, of course, big time for the broadcast industry, too.
Yeah, and you probably had one. You were all excited when you got that 4800 baud modem, probably.
Oh, absolutely! And we were doing our tech segment that you did as our tech expert on Dave FM. We always introduced you with that lovely dial-up sound effect.
Yeah, and every time you did that, Mitch Evans, the sports guy, started looking at his computer. He thought that he was dialing in somewhere.
He thought he had to reconnect.
Well, we'll talk about that. And like I said, it's great having you on. And just kind of wanted to ask you starting out. I mean, I know you a little bit and other people do. You have a lot of fans. Maybe you can just kind of go over where did your love of music and radio kind of develop over the years?
Oh, geez. Back in, early high school, junior high, aside from, our childhood being into like the Beatles and Rolling Stones and the typical radio kind of stuff. I was listening to the Beach Boys as I grew up in Huntington Beach, California. Little Barry Manilow, little England Dan, John Ford Coley, maybe some Olivia Newton.
Bread.
Bread was in there. Yeah, America. Yeah, bands like that. But that was the radio staple of the time. And then my first big concert that I went to was the Beach Boys, Chicago, Santana, and that was in like 75. Frampton Comes Alive. I remember that particular album, Peter Frampton and Aerosmith. Those were like the big adventurous rock bands of the time for me. Pink Floyd, loved that album, of course, Dark Side of the Moon. And then Ozzy Osbourne at the time, Black Sabbath was too scary for me. It gave me nightmares, so I didn't really listen to that. But the turning point was on my 17th birthday in 1976. That's dating me. Gee. My girlfriend at the time said, look, what you listen to is really, really bad. So she says, I'm going to take you to a real rock concert. I went, okay, fine. So for my birthday, she took me to Los Angeles at the Roxy Theater in LA. And the band that was playing there was called the Ramones. And I had no idea who these guys were. They said, oh, they're from New York City. And it was their very first concert on the West Coast. It was their very first concert. And I had no idea what this band was. So these guys all of a sudden, and it's very, very seedy. And I thought it was kind of cool because the bouncer got us in. I was underage, so they snuck me in. And all of a sudden these guys came out and a lot of people were dressed a little bit more, you know, undergroundish, and it was a little intimidating, but these guys came out with their leather jackets and their torn Levi's and something like, hey, so we're the Ramones, thanks for coming out to you, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then they launched into their set and it was about maybe 35 minutes long. And it was like just song after song, boom, 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 boom. And I came out of there with looking a little bit like a stand-up version of the guy from the Memorex commercial. Remember the Memorex speaker guy? And at that point, I went, oh, this is really going to piss off mom. So I discovered
that was not the Beach Boys.
No. This was like a completely different baptizing of rock and roll, if you will. And my life changed completely after that. And I kind of went underground. I started seeking out more of the punk stuff. And then because at that time, the UK punk scene was really starting to come around with Sex Pistols, the Damned, the Buzzcocks, the Jam, all these great bands that I kind of embraced and got a lot of imports. And I kind of shunned else that I listened to prior to that.
Sure. I'm sure you've been asked, because you've had a long career in radio, and I'm sure you've been asked by probably a million and one people, how do I get into radio? And the thing is, you were a cultural anthropology and archaeology major in college. Is that kind of the traditional gateway to getting into radio?
No. That was like as soon as I get done with this and I would want to get into like a real job, I thought anthropology was my first love when I went when I got out of high school. And that was a lot due to Indiana Jones. But the question is not so much how you get into radio, but how do you get out of it, especially now? Because as technology is changing, as you know, radio stations are falling by the wayside. I've seen three of them like get pulled out from under me here within the course of about a year and a half. So it's been very, very tough to sustain one's self in this industry right now, unless you're, you know, a talk show person who already has a good following, or if you're really into Top 40 and you're into reading short little pieces of text, if you will, that your program director gives you, and not doing anything else. Rock radio is kind of on the downslide right now because of the way ratings are gathered. That's another discussion completely about Arbitron and how ratings are grabbed, I guess, for radio and for radio listeners. So it's a very, very tough industry right now, at least for rock radio, but that hopefully will change soon. And then of course now is the advent of internet radio and a lot of other different, you know, music delivery systems, like of course, you know, Pandora, self-created type of radio stations, whether it's I like these artists and I want to hear more from them, or if it's a do-it-yourself kind of radio station. And there's satellite and there's other different means too. So it's competitive by all means.
Yeah, it sure is. And I don't think it's any slight to you and guys like that do what you do, but I think the demographic that you kind of go after, these are smart people who are really into technology and they're using the internet and satellite for their music now. And that's why you think that's maybe why rock stations and maybe alternative rock stations have kind of taken a hit the last couple of years?
That's one of the reasons, I think, but a lot of it has to do with, without sounding kind of, you know, mean or flippant about it, is it's people who are, say, within our demographic, and I'll say the age between 18 and 34, you know, that really technically savvy type of demographic that a lot of rock radio or a lot of bands that are maybe considered alternative bands, they have followers in that particular demographic. They just, they don't want to deal with radio as in terrestrial radio. They say, oh, I don't listen to radio. I don't listen. But we find out through surveys that, independent surveys, that they do. And most people discover new music and new bands through terrestrial radio. They just don't admit it. And when you ask them to participate in a survey or basically carry a meter, it's something that looks like a beeper. It's about the size of an iPhone, and you literally clip it on your belt. This is what Arbitron gives you when you agree to participate in a radio survey, and it just tracks your listening habits. So if you walk into a store, that radio station that might be playing in the store that you're listening to, they get credit for that. If you're at your desk and you're listening to a radio station, your meter will pick that up, and the station will get credit for that. But a lot of people won't participate, at least in the 1834 demographic. They won't participate because they got to carry a beeper, which is just not very easy to do, not very fashion savvy either.
And privacy issues.
Exactly. And they don't want people to know that, hey, what's that thing that's on your belt? Is that a beeper? No, I'm participating in a radio survey. And it's like, they don't want to, do that. It's like, no, thanks. I don't listen to radio. So if they get called, at random by Arbitron and say, would you like to participate in the survey? No, I don't listen to radio. Yeah, but even though they do. So what happens is a very, very, a wonderful, wonderful medium that would normally expose these listeners to brand new music, brand new bands, break these bands, make them popular, tell you about the concerts, all the things that go with alternative rock or rock in general. They don't participate in the survey. Numbers and ratings go down. Stations change format. And that's just what's been happening around the country.
Sure. That kind of brings up the question. When you're on the air, you're planning out your show and your bits, do you kind of worry about the ratings, or do you just kind of are focused on doing what you do best?
A little bit of both. I mean, you always have to consider, the ratings, that people are fickle. And if you're talking about something that they don't necessarily are interested in, or if you already talk about a subject and then all of a sudden you're off on a tangent or whatever, they'll kind of go, oh, gee, what else is on? Or, move on. And people will, if they're listening, if they like a radio station, they'll listen to it for, we find out, about maybe 15 to 20 minutes at a good stretch. And then they do something else. And that might be getting up and getting something from the break room, or they have to jump in the car and go someplace, or they're out of the shower and they have to go on and do something else. People's habits and just their normal life dictate what, radio listening is going to be. So we've been told by the people who do program these stations that one of the best ways to handle your audience is to give them as much as you can in a compelling and concise type of manner without getting in the way of the music, because they tune in for the bands. They tune in for the music. They don't tune in for some disc jockey who's blathering about something. And get in, play maybe, three, four songs, and then they're usually off to something else. So get whatever you can in, like maybe in 15 minutes. I mean, in the way of, a few songs, maybe a couple of bits and whatever. And then hopefully they'll come back when they get a chance. And that's the big key right now with radio programmers, is to not get them to listen for a long, long time, like a half hour, hour, or, their entire work day, which is great if they can do it. But mostly they want people to come back. Like, okay, I'm listening for 15 minutes. I like this particular song. I like this DJ. I like the, the information. I like everything about this radio station. But I got to go to the bathroom. I'll be back in 20 minutes. And you want them to come back and not go to another broadcasting outlet.
Sure, sure. And I think that's always something that you did well. You didn't dominate, your personality didn't dominate the show. The music was always kind of the star of the show, and you kind of gave a little background and demonstrated your knowledge with the music and kind of enhanced that that portion for the listeners. Is that kind of what your philosophy was?
Yeah, and you use the perfect word, enhancement, and that's what DJs and you can call us whatever you want, presenters, hosts,
MCs,
whatever. What we're doing is we're literally playing the music. We are, we hit a button. I mean, you've been in the studio, we hit the button, we play the song, and sometimes we let the songs go back to back. But if we have something to say about the music, or if they're in concert maybe, or hey, did you know this particular news tidbit, or if you can throw something kind of trivia based, so it's like, oh, I didn't know that, and that's my favorite band. If they can maybe learn a little something, feel a little something, maybe get prompted to buy their next album if it's coming out soon, or see their concert if it's on the way. If you can throw that in there in a very like a behind the scenes kind of way, like, oh, by the way, and kind of step in and give this information, but then step right back out. And yeah. One thing I think in my favor that's always come out is I have a passion for this music. I have a passion for rock music. I have since my 17th birthday in 1976. And since then, you get very, very excited when all of a sudden Mumford & Sons comes out with a brand new album that's just as good as the last one, or if Psychedelic Furs are coming in concert and they put on a great live show, things like that. And if you can let the listeners know that without going on and on and on and on and on about, you know, two or three different subjects before you start the next song, then I think you're doing pretty good.
Sure. Yeah, I definitely agree. And since this is the Tech of Sports, you've also dabbled a little in sports broadcasting with a couple of different jobs. And one of those was, I believe you were with minor league baseball for a while. Then you've also dabbled as a PA announcer for NHL hockey. Is that correct?
Yeah. So instead of sports casting, it's called arena casting.
Arena casting. We'll talk about that in a second. But did you do play-by-play for minor league baseball?
No. Well, actually, an old friend of mine, when I was living in Salt Lake City, Chris Matthews, and he's now the news anchor for News 8 in Las Vegas. So he worked his way into television sports. The two of us would sit on the front row of the seats right next to third base at the old Salt Lake Gulls baseball games, which were like minor league games, obviously. And we'd sit there by ourselves and call the game. And I would do play-by-play, or he'd do play-by-play. I'd do color commentary or whatever. And I remember every time I would stumble, because it's not my forte, every time I would stumble, he would go, dead air, they're all turning their radios off. Dead air, what are you going to say next? He's about to pitch. And he would just like dog me about it. And that was my only play-by-play.
But, this was minor league baseball. What the heck?
Exactly. Minor league baseball is fun. And so that's in 1988 is when I started, 1988. A friend of mine said, "Hey, you know, there's one of the guys that I know is the PA announcer for the Riverside Red Wave was the name of the team in Riverside, California." And he said, "You ought to talk to Leanne, the general manager, about maybe getting in and doing the PA work." And so I went and talked with her. She'd heard my show before. She said, "Yeah, you ever done this before?" I go, "No, but a good friend of mine does it for the San Bernardino Spirit, which is another minor league team in that league." And so she auditioned me for a game and she liked it. And then I became the PA announcer for the Riverside Red Wave. And they moved to Adelanto, California, out in the desert. And they became the High Desert Mavericks, who are still in business today. And they're a Padres minor league team. So the San Diego Padres. And the year that I agreed to, you know, commute into the desert and do these games, I said, "Okay, well, I want, you know, so much per game, and I want all the hot dogs and beer before and after the game. And if you guys win, I want a championship ring." And the general manager said, "Done. Good to have you back." And then, of course, what they do, they actually won the championship for the California League that year, their inaugural year. So I got this big, nice, fat San Diego Padres championship ring with a big diamond in the middle. It's got my name on it. It's great.
That is cool. That's a great conversation piece. And I think you also, when the Atlanta Thrashers were here in town in Atlanta, and when you were up in New York, you did the PA or some of the PA for the Thrashers and then the Rangers up in New York. Yeah. And I've always said hockey is the hardest sport not only to announce play-by-play, but it's also the hardest sport to announce PA-wise. You feel the same way?
I had help. There's the play-by-play was a guy, Mike Komrick, who is like the best, you know, caller of NHL games, is just phenomenal. But yeah, it's a very difficult game to call. But as PA goes, if you're doing it kind of by yourself, yeah, it's pretty difficult. And I was lucky enough to get in there and have some great people to work with. Peter Sorkoff is one who's still working with the Hawks as their game ops coordinator. Kind of talked me through, you know, how to do it, and was always there with, you know, a lot of encouragement. And I finally, you know, fine-tuned it and made it work really well for everyone there. But I had a guy who was down on the – because a lot of the announcers are on the ice. They're actually right next to the officials, and that's where they call the games from, the PA announcers. But I was way up on, like, the eighth floor of Phillips Arena. And I had a guy, Eric Brownson, who I called Jack in the Box because he was down there in by the penalty boxes. And he would deal with the officials. So if something happened on the ice, a whistle went up, and they would come in, they would say it's a hooking penalty on number 47 for the Red Wings, whatever, and he would call that up to me on my headset. So as soon as the action would stop, the music would start in the arena, and then I would come back with all the information that he would relay up to me. So when it was ready, when the puck dropped, then I had penalty Red Wings number 37, 2 minutes for high stick, time of the penalty, blank, whatever it was. So he would call up the time of the penalty, and he would do everything for me. So he fed me all the info. Same thing for goals. If a goal was scored, there was always a goal and maybe a couple of assists, and we didn't know what that was at the time. So when the goal was scored, then the buzzer went off and the music wouldn't go crazy, and so would the crowd. And then I would listen for Jack in the Box to give me the information. Okay, the goal scored by number 17, assist number 27 and 32. And so I'd look at my roster and I'd say, okay, Ilya Kovalchuk with the goal, assisted by this person or this person, and he'd give me time of the goal, and I'd put that all like in a little fill in the blank kind of script. And then as soon as the puck would drop, my producer would go, okay, go. And then I could yell, Atlanta goal scored by number 17, Ilya Kovalchuk. Crowd would go nuts, assisted by number 34 and number 27, or that kind of thing. I just yelled and I hurt my throat. Right. That's how kind of the game would go. But it's a nice little tag team operation between a couple of guys. And in New York for the Rangers, I was like their substitute PA announcer. So if one of the normal guys would get sick, I would fill in. And they're real serious about hockey up there. I mean, they're very, very serious. And it's not a lot of fun in games like it was at the Thrashers games, because Atlanta, not being a, quote, hockey town, New York is all about hockey, but it's very, very old school. So there's not a lot of, fun, not a lot of games going on, but I learned how to be a more serious PA announcer there with the Rangers, and I did two games all total. Mostly was reading the announcements. I wasn't doing the goals scored or the penalties or anything like that. I was doing a lot of the cutaway announcements during the timeouts and stop and play.
Yeah, I bet that was a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, when you're in Madison Square Garden and all of a sudden your voice is on the PA. Oh man.
It's a dream come true for you there.
Absolutely.
Let's take a quick break here. We've got one little break here for Amazon.com, and just want to let all the listeners know that if they're doing any shopping here this holiday season, Black Friday coming up, and then, of course, December is just going to be a madhouse of shopping. You can use the affiliate link here at the studio, netcaststudio.com/Amazon, for all your needs, and there's no extra cost to you as a customer, and it helps support the studio here and the programs here at the studio. Once again, it's netcaststudio.com/Amazon, and it really helps us out, and feel free to use that. So really appreciate you being on here, Steve, and we'll give you a second here to plug what you have going on now. But what do you see as the biggest change in radio and broadcasting technology over the 20-plus years you've been in? Is it maybe something in the studio, or the way you do remotes, or just something as far as the tools of your trade, what's changed the most?
I think digital music and digital music delivery has really, really changed the industry. So when I started, it was literally two turntables and a microphone and a whole bunch of 45s and LPs, and you just did your broadcast that way. And then, of course, it moved into tapes. They look like cartridges. We used to call them carts in the business. They look a little bit like 8-track cartridges, but they're only 2-track. And you'd have a song on one, you have a commercial on another, and everything was worked that way. But then it got to CDs, which the quality was a lot better. You didn't have to deal with vinyl and pops and clicks and scratches. And you didn't have to deal with tapes getting worn out and getting muddy sounding. So it was, love it or hate it, because vinyl is the best really way to hear music. I'm a big vinyl advocate. I love a good turntable setup with a good quality sound system and speakers. You can really hear good analog music. I mean, music that was recorded either analog or digitally. It just sounds better. And a lot of people always say it sounds warmer. But when you're broadcasting, you kind of lose that aspect. So when CDs became popular, then it sounded a lot better. It sounded cleaner. But then it got into putting your music on an MP3 type format, and everything was put into programs like, people won't recognize these names, but like Audio Vault, Prophet, Enco, all these different types of systems where you just load up all your music and then everything is worked on one big or two big touch screens. And so you just, you know, you'd touch or you'd load up something and hit the button on the control board and everything was always there. You never had to go back and search for an album or flip through a whole bunch of 45s or search for something on a big rack of carts. It was all at your fingertips. And that really streamlined the business and made us able to concentrate more on content instead of spending our time literally jockeying discs, which is where the term came from.
Sure. Absolutely. People, a lot of people don't know that. And you know, and when I came on your show and on Dave FM, and we kind of would joke and you would kind of play like you didn't know anything about technology, but you're actually a pretty tech savvy guy and have been around technology. And as we came onto the show, we talked a little bit about it, but you actually, along with your love of music, you also have always had an interest in technology, right?
Absolutely. And when you would come in on your segment and you would always bring in the newest tech gadgets, which were great. And I don't really keep up too much on what, you know, the new technology or the new, or I don't want to call them gadgets, but the new devices that people either use for entertainment or enhance their lives. You're on the cutting edge of that, obviously. So I come to it secondhand. But early on, I was a big fan of Apple. I was a big Apple fan because when personal computers first started coming out, I had a friend of mine set up an Apple II Plus computer at the radio station I was working at. And I learned a little bit about programming and I got to do a little bit of basic code. And we had our Apple II Plus doing schedules, programming some of the music playlists, creating labels for our carts, and just doing rudimentary work, really nothing that was going to be changing to the industry changing or anything like that. And then it kind of went on and on and on, and I got my first personal computer, which happened to be an Apple. It was an Apple II GS. And all of a sudden, it's like, wow, I got my own personal computer. I can start doing the stuff I would normally do at work at home and learn even more about it. And then Apple sadly pretty much abandoned that the Apple II line right as the GS came out. And the GS was a wonderful computer. It was great. It was GS was graphics and sound. And that's exactly what it was. It was just wonderful. It was affordable. And I had it maybe 6 months before all the software started coming off the shelves in favor of the Macintosh line. Right, and right. Then all of a sudden it just disappeared completely. And I think John Sculley was the CEO at the time. And I remember cursing him and throwing things. And I was upset because it's like, you abandoned me. I was with you from the beginning. How could you do this? And I swore off Apple. I said, I would never buy another Apple product ever, ever. And then I got into the PC world, and PCs are, you know, in the Windows world are very, it's cumbersome. And I didn't really get into too much gadgetry at that point. I mean, I had, you know, my Xbox, and I worked with Mattel Electronics early on. I remember those old Mattel Electronics games, Mattel Electronics football, where all it was. Yeah. It was just like just little blips on a screen, but they made it look like it was these blips are moving in a stadium. Yep. It was like, okay, and they programmed it to where you had to move the blip around the other blip, being offense and defense, and that was, you know, something that we all really got into. I remember having the first Pong game, which was called Odyssey, I believe, for the TV, and then Odyssey morphed into, oh, it's Pong back and forth. Let's put this overlay that looks like a soccer field. And all of a sudden you have a soccer game.
Sure.
But I was into that kind of gadgetry. And then, but as it kind of went along, and I was in my kind of PC mode, here comes the iPod. And I think I had at that point, my little, we all had Sony Walkmans, but I had, something that was an iOmega Hip Zip. That's what I had. And you put these big discs, which are about, you know, maybe the size of your palm, and you put that into the little player, and it held like 7 songs. And then here comes the iPod, and everybody had iPods, and they held, you know, thousands of titles. And I kind of went, okay, it's Apple, but all right, I'll buy an iPod. And I broke my cardinal rule of never to touch Apple. And then I bought another iPod, and the new version came out. I bought another iPod, and then I bought another one. And then all of a sudden,
it was all over at that point.
I know. And then the iPhone comes out. It's like, okay, I'll buy an iPhone. And then after the iPhone, which is an amazing piece of technology that, of course, you, Rick Limpert, do not embrace yet.
the Android phones are just as good.
Oh, shut up. and then I went and got, I ditched my old Toshiba laptop, and I bought myself a MacBook Pro. And my life has changed. So
it's a great computer.
I have a radio station broadcasting right this very moment out of my MacBook Pro.
Promote that.
Well, after Dave FM sadly went away, and also 99X went shortly before that. And as you know, I was on 99X for 17 years before its first demise. Then it died first. Then it came back as a zombie, and then they finally put a bullet in his head. That's my analogy. But then myself and a few other people who are working on 99X, Jill Melanson, who was also on Dave FM, Barnes, Sean Demery, Jimmy Barron, we all did radio shows on X99 Radio, which was an internet radio station hosted by Live 365, which is a great clearinghouse for radio stations. And it's an inexpensive way for you to broadcast your own radio station. And we started doing the X99, which is similar format as Dave FM. Playing a lot of new music, and we would do our bit breaks, voice breaks, introducing new music and playing a lot of new bands, sweepers, like in between kind of stuff. Actually, Barnes was using Siri from the iPhone 5 to do our image voices. Yeah, and she was the voice of the station. And then that was kind of an experiment to see how people would react to it, which they did. We had, I think, close to like 5,000 listening hours for the first month, which was phenomenal. But it does cost, and it's a lot of effort to do. It's time consuming. So we're trying to find a way right now. We took it off the air, so to speak, and we're trying to find a way to partner with a large brand to bring it back and monetize it. So the advertiser that we partner with will benefit from it. We can make some money so we can actually, put the man hours and the cost into it. Because the cost is royalties. People don't know that. It's like, why don't you do your own radio show? Because if you start playing music and broadcasting it on the internet, you're gonna owe ASCAP and BMI a lot of money. So that's where a lot of it becomes cost prohibitive, because you have to pay the royalties. So Live 365 takes care of that with a certain amount of listeners that you expect. There's like a cap for listeners. And we had on X99, we had a 100-seat cap. And if you were the 101st person who wanted to log in and listen, it wouldn't let you log in unless you had VIP status, which is like $7 a month. And that would allow you instant access on any of their formats. And there's thousands of them. And now one of those formats, which I've got going right now, is the old Haunted House of Retro Pleasure, was my Halloween show that I did. I would do a series of five of these leading up to Halloween. It was usually part of my lunchtime show on 99X, which was the old House of Retro Pleasure or Retroplex, whatever you want to call it. And I would do that as a specialty type of week. And so I'm doing that right now 24/7 with all the same tracks and movie clips and spooky stuff that I always had for that. And that's on the air right now through Live 365.
Yeah, it's very cool. And once they fine tune the technology a little bit and kind of make it where it's affordable. And I know there's little ad spots on there right now that this is a real viable option for a DJ that has a following and a name to almost be an entrepreneur and start out up, for themselves.
Absolutely. And then you can tie it into a website, and a lot of radio personalities or DJs, they all have their own website. I'm going to be launching my new website, which is thestevshow.com. It's not active yet. We're still working on it, but it'll have a lot of the stuff that I would do during my show in the way of content, music content, this date in history, and Steve's College of Musical Knowledge, the Punk Trunk. A lot of these different features I'll have set up for audio and video content on a daily basis. So if a certain event happens in music history, it'll be there with a video and some commentary. Same thing with all the other features. And also the Retroplex, which is the 80s new wave, classic alternative punk kind of stuff from the 80s that I love. It's one of my favorite genres of music. That'll be like an hour or 2 hour long podcast. That'll be available every day. I'll change
That'd
that up
great,
every day.
Right?
Yeah. So everything that I would normally do for the Steve Show, whether it was on Dave FM or 99X or WRXP up in New York, will be available on my website once it gets all finished up.
That'll be real cool. And maybe Wireless Wednesday will make an occasional appearance on there.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the thing, because once you have this type of webcast, you can pretty much include anything you want.
Sure,
so if you
want
to partner with someone like Rick Limpert, if I want to partner with you, I could have, you know, links to your podcast or your broadcast there as well, and it kind of goes goes both ways.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing that Barnes and I were doing with X99. We were promoting the Haunted House of Retro Pleasure coming up as a, you know, 5-day special, and on my show I was going to be promoting X99. Of course, it's no longer there, but, you know, things always change in the future.
That's kind of wanted to touch on before we wrap up here, that there's another side to Steve Craig that maybe a lot of people don't know from the radio personality. And you're kind of a Renaissance man yourself. You're an avid scuba diver, and you're a pilot, and you're really involved with Angel Flight, which is a real great cause. And just talk about that for a minute.
Wonderful organization. I got with Angel Flight after I learned to fly back in the mid 90s. And that's something I always wanted to do. Is just, you know, I since I was a little kid, and my dad took me to the airport, you know, to watch the planes take off and land. I'm a big military history buff for World War II, and so World War II aviation was always a big fascination of mine. But after a while, and you talk about gadgets early on, I mean, I was a big flight simulator person. I mean, I had all the gadgets that I could have on my desktop unit. I had the joystick that did everything. And I had like a, you know, massive screen, and I had, you know, not a Microsoft Flight Simulator, but I had a lot of these World War II programs. So I was really getting into that. I mean, I would spend hours and hours and hours in front of the computer just being the fantasy pilot or virtual aviator, as we were calling ourselves. But then after the success of 99X, and I had a little house that I bought, and I sold it and made a pretty good profit. And so I thought I had, you know, a little bit extra money. So I thought, maybe I'll buy a plane. And I got my pilot's license before that, but then I bought my own little plane, and which is big money pit, but I don't regret it at all, because it was a broken down piece of crap, and I restored it with some friends, my mechanic, my avionics guy, and we restored this beautiful, beautiful little Piper Cherokee 180. That was a 1973 model, and it was just beautiful. It was the pride of the airport up at McCollum, which is Cobb County Airfield. Mm-hmm. And just a beautiful little plane. I had a lot of fun with it. And I thought, I always saw this big display at the airport for Angel Flight. And they had these teddy bears, and they looked like little aviator bears. And then there was all these pictures of pilots and little children. And I inquired more about it. I didn't really know what it was, and come to find out that it was an organization of volunteer pilots who would fly, for lack of a better term, mercy missions for free. We would dedicate our time as pilots to fly adults and children, anyone needing assistance in transportation to different medical centers. Because, as you know, if you have someone, a loved one, who is maybe suffering through cancer treatments, insurance might pay for the actual treatments, but they're not going to pay for the transportation. And if you have to go to different cancer centers around the Southeast, or maybe the big one, MD Anderson in Houston, it's very expensive to go back and forth on commercial airlines. And they don't give you a discount for it. And so what we try to do at Angel Flight is eliminate that cost. So if there's a series of treatments that you can only have maybe in Houston, we'll pick up a flight, or a mission, as we call it, and I'd fly, say, the patient and maybe a couple of people with him or her, from Cobb County Airport. I'd fly into, say, Meridian, Mississippi, a good halfway point, and then I would hand off to another pilot who would fly the patient to Houston. And then we'd have ground services pick them up, take them to the treatment center, all free of charge. And the flights that I would do a lot with Angel Flight locally were flights into Emory University, because they had a very well organized and very well respected craniofacial, I forget what the actual term is, but for
reconstruction.
Yeah, and I call them helmet kids, because they are basically born with a non-life-threatening, misshapen cranium. And these helmets that they would wear, and they would have to have adjusted on a weekly basis, would help form their cranium into a normal shape.
Right.
And so that's really expensive, especially if you're living in, say, Knoxville, Tennessee, and you have to fly into Atlanta to go to the Emory Center to get your kid's helmet adjusted twice a week. And so we would pick up those flights because they were fairly short flights, maybe an hour and a half back and forth, hour and a half one way. And so I would have them taxi over from Emory, and I'd take them back, and then I would fly back or either way. Sometimes you'd fly out and pick them up, bring them back. And the kids are wonderful because as soon as they get in the back of the plane and you fire the engine up, they just immediately go to sleep. And so the chance for me to talk with the parents and then fly them over. And it was wonderful to see the kids, you know, literally, you know, get older and you see how they progress with their treatments. And there are some great stories. There were some that are pretty sad. There were a couple of missions that I took where they were flying people home from cancer treatment centers because nothing could be done. And it was just such an advanced situation for them that they would literally be flying home to be with their loved ones in their final days.
Sure,
and
sure.
A lot of these stories that they people would use up every amount of all their funds and all their insurance, and they couldn't make it home. They would literally have to spend their final days in a hospital, which is they obviously wouldn't want to do. So we'd pick up those flights and bring them home. But there's like a whole bunch of different stories, good outcomes, some that weren't that good, but you know, we were always there to help. And Angel Flight does that, a completely nonprofit. And you can find out more through their website, which is Angel Flight Soars, SOARS, .org. And find out more about it if you know someone who might be needing this type of service.
It's truly a great organization, and there's a lot of pilots I know in Atlanta that are involved in it. Atlanta's a real good town for Angel Flight. So
it's a nice
kudos to all the pilots that are involved in it.
Wonderful people, and it's just a great organization to be involved in because it's a lot of like-minded people with, you know, with regard to aviation. And I think a lot of people who have gotten to the point where they have, you know, not big aircraft, I mean, like maybe some personal jets, private jets, they really do a lot to return the favor and help out organizations all over the country through Angel Flight. And it's a really, really good group of people.
Sure, sure. Yeah, it really is a good organization. As we wrap up here, Steve, I always ask my guests one last question. What's the one piece of modern technology or gadget that you can't live without today? I'm sure I know. I think I know what the answer to it is, but let's hear it from you.
My Xbox. No. it would have to be my iPhone because, I mean, like you say, the Android technology, all the different smartphone technologies have really changed our lives. Some will say for the worse. Society will say, yeah, we don't talk to one another anymore. But that is probably the most important piece of technology that I have right now because, and you know this as well as I do, when all of a sudden you can't find it, and you're like,
gosh,
where did I put it? You panic. I mean, your heart goes into defib. You just kind of just panic. Like, where's my phone? Not for fear of someone else getting your data, but just, I can't live without it. Where did it go?
Yeah, we have our whole lives on these phones now. Our calendars, our address book, phone book, you know, banking information, pictures. I mean, we really have our whole lives on these phones now.
Everything. And the only other piece of technology that I probably can't live without, that would be my crushed ice maker in my tiki bar.
Oh, well, of course. You're also, I forgot to mention, you're also an experienced bartender. So you have to keep up with the latest technology in that.
It's mixologist.
There you go. You're a amateur mix. Well, I don't know. Are you a professional mixologist or an amateur mixologist these days?
Oh, totally amateur. Totally
okay.
Amateur.
Okay. It's like a scene from Cocktail, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, I can't flip the shakers or anything like Tom Cruise could, but I can make a really mean Mai Tai.
All right, that's the Leaky Tiki, and if anyone's ever invited, I say never turn down a trip to the Leaky Tiki. So
absolutely.
Steve, it's been great having you. Whoop, I got one more thing here for you.
Yeah.
Can you stump Steve? Stump Steve, stump Steve, stump Steve.
No!
Can you stump Steve? Stump Steve, stump Steve, stump Steve.
Can you hear that, Steve?
Oh, yeah. So you want to ask me a question? Go ahead.
I got one easy one and one tough one, I think.
Okay.
So we'll see how you do here. I couldn't resist. So
all right.
And thanks to Jeremy for getting me the music.
I'm gonna kill him.
I shouldn't have said anything. All right. Here's one for you. I would think this one is easy. My favorite band is Poco, back country rock band, 70s and 80s. Can you tell me who the two musicians were that were both members of Poco and the Eagles?
Oh, man.
Because the Eagles were kind of famous for raiding the rating Poco for musicians when they had a member leave the Eagles. So can, yes. do you know who those two musicians are? One is still currently a member of the Eagles.
One was Randy Meisner, wasn't he?
That is correct. That's the tough one.
That's the tough one. I got the tough one. Now the easy one's gonna, this one's gonna get me. Man, it was the guy who left and came back.
Yes.
Oh, I can't think.
Boy, that surprised me. I thought you would have got that one. Timothy B. Schmidt.
Timothy B. Schmidt. That's it. Because okay. I sometimes think of Timothy B. Schmidt as being with the Doobie Brothers for some reason.
I think he was. I think he did play some Doobie Brothers songs. Well, maybe, he played with a couple different bands.
That's where I got it mixed up. So I'm half right. Okay. And what's the tough? What's the tough one?
Here's what I thought was the tougher one, but maybe this will be easier for you. What Michael Jackson hit single did Guns N' Roses guitarist Slash play on in 1991?
It's either Billie Jean or Beat It, and I think it's Beat It. Billie Jean?
Nope.
Really?
No. 1991.
Oh, 1991. Is that the one that Slash played in?
Yeah, Slash played guitar on what Michael Jackson single, 1991.
In 1991, man,
it's really the only song that you would listen to, a Michael Jackson song you would listen to and hear kind of a Slash guitar type going on in it. So
because Eddie Van Halen played in the one back in the '80s. In
what, did I stump Steve twice?
Oh, shut up! I'm in the tiki bar. What do you want? I've been drinking rum. I want to say it's like Man in the Mirror, but that's not that.
No, it was Black or White.
Really? I didn't know that. Yeah. Slash played on that. Interesting.
Yeah, that's, I gotcha.
See, even I learned something.
That's the goal of, that's the whole goal of radio and internet radio. You want to try to learn something.
Now, I'm just so out of practice. I'm rusty right now.
You are. We got to drill you. We got to get Jeremy on the phone, and we got to get you back up to speed.
Thanks.
I didn't want to ask any Ramones or Dave Matthews question. I figured you would have got those.
That's easy stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Ask me, Mike. Yeah. Ask me about Michael Jackson and the Eagles. There you go.
Well, I'm just preparing you. Maybe if you get on a more classic rock station.
Well, Star 94 did call me, but no.
All right. We won't talk about any of that. Steve, it's been great having you on, and now I can wear my badge proudly that I stumped Steve.
Thanks, Rick. I'll send you a certificate.
And tell the listeners again how they can follow you on social media and your website again coming up.
Facebook, and I post everything right now on Facebook and Twitter, just with activity and what I'm doing with the Haunted House of Retro Pleasure and the Steve Show website coming up. But it's facebook.com/TheSteveShow, and on Twitter it's @TheSteveShow, and that's the best way to follow me at this point.
It's excellent. You do a good job on social media. You post little news tidbits on there, and enjoy following you on there, and really enjoyed having you on the show, Steve. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate it, and always good to talk to you and learn some new stuff, too.
Great. Good having you on. We'll talk to you soon. I just want to let all the listeners know that Netcast Studio has many other shows which may be of interest, and you can head over to netcaststudio.com and check out all the shows available. And also a quick mention of Radio CSS, our partner network, radiocss.com. You've been listening to the Tech of Sports podcast, a Netcast Studio production.